Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to unpack ideas, help you get well-informed, fast. Now, you hear AI everywhere today, right? And usually you think, well, artificial intelligence, computers, tech, all that. But we're looking at a different AI today, an older one, artificial integrity.
Yeah, that's it. And it's fascinating because, I mean, long before we had silicon chips, humans had kind of mastered their own version of AI. We were talking about that tendency, that very human thing of putting forward this carefully crafted image, you know, looking righteous on the outside.
Even if it doesn't quite match what's going on inside.
Exactly. And it's not new. You see it in the ancient stories and culture today. It's this timeless struggle, really, for being genuine.
So our mission for this deep dive is to help you start recognizing the signs, the warning signs of that kind of artificiality. And not just, you know, in history books, but maybe, and this is the tricky part, maybe in our own lives, too.
It was a journey, isn't it? Moving from just performing to something real, that sort of heart-deep integrity.
Okay. And to guide us, we're using excerpts from Artificial Integrity, Confronting the Pretenders. We're really zeroing in on this pretty intense moment between Jesus and the Pharisees, the religious leaders back then. It's all in Matthew chapter 23.
Right. We want to unpack why Jesus literally called them the pretenders and what that means or could mean for us now.
Okay, let's jump into that historical scene then. Matthew 23, starting around verse 1, Jesus is talking to the crowds and also his disciples. And he says something pretty striking right off the bat. He says, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. But then he adds, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. Wow, what's the core tension there?
Well, it's a real paradox, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's basically saying, look, listen to their teaching. Why? Because they are in a position of authority, they represent the established leadership teaching from Scripture.
They sit in Moses' seat.
Exactly. But then comes the punch. Don't copy their actions. He recognizes the legitimacy of their role, their office.
But slams their actual behavior.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It immediately highlights that gap, you know, knowing what's right versus actually living it. That classic disconnect.
Yeah, separating the message from the messenger's own life.
Yeah.
That feels very relevant today, too. You see that sometimes. And he goes further, right? He criticizes them about these heavy burdens. Our source calls them massive, complicated religious rules they'd added on top of the original law of Moses.
Yeah, things that maybe started out with good intentions, like trying to help people apply the law.
But they got elevated, like equal to God's law.
That's what happened. They became these heavy legalistic rules. And the real kicker, Jesus points out, that the leaders who imposed all this,
they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them.
Right. The hypocrisy is just stark.
Ah.
They created this restrictive system for others, but seem to exempt themselves.
So it weighs everyone else down, but not them.
It really shows that pitfall. You know, when human traditions start to overshadow the actual heart of God's intent, it becomes oppressive, lacking mercy, maybe even becomes a tool for control, not spiritual growth.
Okay, so it wasn't just what they taught or even how they lived, but the why, the motivation behind it all. Jesus says it directly. Everything they do is done for people to see.
Yeah. That's the core of it. Not about genuinely honoring God, but about getting credit, social points for being super devout.
And the source gives examples like making their phylacteries really wide. Those little scripture boxes.
Worn during prayer.
Or making the tassels on their clothes extra long. He's not saying the items are bad.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It's the show.
Yeah.
The excessive display just to get noticed, to get approval.
And loving the best seats at dinners, the important spots in the synagogue.
Wanting people to greet them respectfully in public. Call them rabbi.
It sounds like it's all about external validation.
It really peels back the layers, doesn't it? Jesus isn't just pointing out the actions. He's exposing the intent, that desire for public recognition, for titles, for status. It reveals that very human need for external approval.
Often over like actual internal substance.
Exactly. It's a performance, carefully constructed to impress.
Which brings us to the whole issue with titles. Jesus gives a direct command about this. He says, but you are not to be called rabbi. You have one teacher. And do not call anyone on earth father. You have one father. Nor are you to be called instructors. You have one instructor, the Messiah. Now, he doesn't mean literally don't call your dad father.
No, no, it's not about literal family terms. It's about avoiding a kind of spiritual status grab, setting yourself up as having this ultimate authority that really only belongs to God.
Ah, okay. So it's a warning against elevating yourself above others in that spiritual sense.
Yes. It's a profound call to humility. True spiritual influence Jesus shows, comes through service, not titles. He drives it home. The greatest among you will be your servant. And that other principle, you know, those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. That echoes elsewhere too.
Okay, so that sets the stage. But then Jesus really lowers the boom with what the source calls the seven woes.
Yeah, this is where it gets incredibly intense.
He uses that phrase, woe to you, seven times. Our source says this amounts to an official rejection of these leaders. But these aren't just like historical insults, are they? There are lessons here for us.
Oh, absolutely. These woes are incredibly precise. They're like diagnoses of different kinds of artificial integrity. Each one highlights a specific way hypocrisy shows up. And they act like a mirror, really.
Yeah.
Asking us to look at our own lives, our beliefs, our actions coming from a genuine place. Or is it just performance?
Yeah. All right, let's unpack the first one. Our source calls it artificial beliefs. Matthew 23:13. Jesus says, woe to you, you hypocrites. You shut the door of the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. So their pretense actually stops other people.
It does. That's the ripple effect. By saying one thing but doing another, they create this barrier. They don't get in themselves, and their inconsistency becomes a stumbling block for others who are genuinely seeking.
Wow.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? How might our inconsistencies, even unintentional ones, maybe put up barriers for people around us looking for truth?
That's a heavy thought. Okay, woe number two. The source calls it artificial leadership. Verse 15, this one is stark. You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when you have succeeded, you make them twice as much a child of hell as you are. Whoa, he's not against converting people, surely.
No, it's not the effort he condemns. It's what they're converting people to.
Ah, not to God, but to their system.
Exactly. A system built on human rules, rejecting the real Messiah. It's a warning against leading people into a faith that's just external rules, just dogma without a changed heart.
So we need to ask ourselves, are we guiding people toward like just church attendance or just charity or just a political view?
Right. Or are we pointing them towards that deeper heart level transformation that genuine faith is really about?
Okay, that clarifies things. Let's move to the third woe, artificial promises, verses 16 to 22. Jesus calls them blind guides here. He talks about these weird loopholes they made for making vows, like swearing by the temple itself didn't count, but swearing by the gold in the temple was binding.
Yeah, or swearing by the altar meant nothing, but swearing by the gift on the altar did. It's convoluted.
It sounds like trying to have your cake and eat it, too. Like spiritual loopholes.
And Jesus just calls it out. He exposes how, well, frankly, how stupid it is. The gold gets its value from the temple. The gift gets its value from the altar. But he also calls out the deception. The source puts it bluntly.
Yeah.
It's like making a promise with your fingers crossed. Any intentional misleading, any word twisting to get out of something, it's a lie.
So the takeaway is just be straightforward.
Pretty much. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. If you're playing games with the truth, making promises you know you won't keep, that's a sign of that artificial integrity.
Makes you think about how careful we need to be with our words. Okay, fourth woe, artificial generosity, verses 23, 24. This is where he criticizes them for tithing, like down to the tiniest spices, mint, dill, cumin.
Super meticulous about the small stuff.
Right. But then they completely ignore, he says, the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. And he uses that amazing analogy. You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel.
It's such a powerful image. Yeah. Missing the whole point, right? Oh, focusing on the tiny details of the law.
Not because they loved God, but for what? Pride.
Tower. Seems like it. Pride, power, glory. They miss the forest for the trees. They care more about the performance than about God's actual heart for justice and compassion. For us, it's a check. When we give, time or money, is it genuinely from the heart? Are we cheerful givers? Or is it just obligation? We're keeping up appearances.
That definitely adds depth to the idea of generosity. Okay, fifth woe, continuing the theme, artificial purity. Verses 25, 26. He says they, quote, clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. And his instruction is, clean the inside first, then the outside will become clean too.
Another stark image. It's all about that public image versus the inner reality. Our actions might look pure, you know, we could polish the outside really well.
But it's superficial if the inside isn't right.
Exactly. The source connects this to needing that inner cleansing, maybe through reflection, through engaging with profound truths like scripture talks about. Genuine purity has to start from within. It flows outward.
Inside out, not outside in. Got it. Okay, sixth woe, artificial righteousness. Verses 27, 28. This one is maybe the most chilling image yet. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. That's graphic.
It really is. Tombs back then were whitewashed partly so people wouldn't accidentally touch them and become ritually unclean. So they look clean, appealing even.
But inside, decay.
Right. And Jesus uses that for the Pharisees. Beautiful facade, looked righteous, pious, but inside, full of hypocrisy and wickedness. It forces us to ask, where's our focus? Are we more concerned with looking good to others, maintaining that image, than actually cultivating that inner life, pleasing God? The source says you can become dead on the inside that way.
Wow. Okay, one more. The seventh woe, artificial honor, verses 29-36. This feels like the climax of the critique. He points out how they build these fancy tombs for the prophets our ancestors killed, decorate the graves.
Saying, oh, if we'd been alive back then, we wouldn't have done that.
Right. But Jesus says, by doing this, they testify against yourselves that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. And then that really sharp, almost challenging line, go ahead then and complete what your ancestors started.
It's incredibly powerful. It exposes this deep, hard-hearted rebellion, as the source calls it. They honor dead prophets with stone monuments.
While rejecting the living ones.
Exactly. They were actively persecuting God's current messengers, John the Baptist, Jesus himself, and soon his apostles. They were literally finishing the job their ancestors started, just against new targets.
So honoring the past felt safe, but facing the present challenge from God was too much.
It seems so. Yep. And that challenge from Jesus, go ahead. It's almost letting them fill up the measure of their guilt. It leads us to think, how do we respond when we're confronted with truth, with messages that challenge us? Do we reject them? If so, maybe we're echoing that same pattern.
Okay, we've covered a lot. Jesus in Matthew 23. It's this intense unpacking of artificial integrity, all its forms, performance, heavy burdens, bad motives, loopholes, misplaced priorities, the whole whitewashed tomb thing.
It's comprehensive.
Yeah.
And it's crucial to grasp the timing here.
Yeah.
This whole speech, these woes, this is basically the end of Jesus's public teaching ministry.
Really? After this, no more big public lessons.
Pretty much. His focus shifts mostly to his disciples, more private instruction. So these warnings, delivered publicly right before that shift, they carry this extra weight, this sense of urgency, of finality.
So here's where it gets really interesting for you listening. Jesus's last public words include that challenge of the seventh woe, like, go ahead then. Mm-hmm. It makes you think, how many chances do we get? How many opportunities will you have to confront artificial integrity maybe in your own life? What does this all mean for you?
And that raises a really vital question to chew on. Thinking about that seventh woe, that final public challenge, how do you tend to respond to profound truth or to those messengers, people, experiences, convictions that might be calling you to deeper honesty, deeper change? What's the real cost at the end of the day of focusing so much on keeping up that impressive exterior, maybe at the expense of cultivating what's truly real and genuine deep inside? That's definitely something worth mulling over.